Good morning, everybody. Happy Thursday. Welcome on into today's Freight Waves Now Community Spotlight. I'm Kaylee Nix, and it's time to get loaded and start rolling with Thomas Wasson. And Thomas, we had some pretty big news breakdown this week. Tuesday morning, unfortunately, we saw quite the collision going on between a cargo ship and a bridge out in Baltimore. And that was our big news maker this week. And unfortunately, not a good situation.
Yes, unfortunately not. The Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, you may remember, oh say can you see, the Baltimore Bridge is no more. A container ship has crashed into it. A little bit of trivia there for y'all. But looking at the impacts, as your friendly neighborhood trucking expert here, few things stand to mind. One, if you're trucking in rail, it's not as bad. Now you may say 31,000 vehicles go across that bridge every single day, but that Baltimore market is kind of in its very own unique little place in terms of the broader supply chain. When we looked at some of the tender data talking with Zach Strickland, around like 30, a little over a third, around 35% of the outbound loads are usually the intra-regional kind of Virginia, intra-Maryland, a lot of shorter haul lengths. And so we're trying to really suss out the impacts. It's really going to be felt in that maritime import sector, especially automotive. If you ever watched the show The Wire, Baltimore Harbor imports quite a bit of automobiles and it exports coal of all things. So there's a lot of stuff to unpack. It's very early. Going to take about a week for us to suss this out. But, you know, we should be starting to see if it's going to have an impact on spot rates, maritime rates, with usually in the next few days after an event occurs. So it's something worth watching.
Yeah, so unfortunately, what we know about this incident is that it was a Maersk-operated ship that apparently lost power, thus losing control, drifted into one of the support posts of that bridge, which ended up taking it down. It was about 3 a.m. on Tuesday morning. And so far, there are some reports of some fatalities, and our hearts, of course, go out to those families there. And the recovery efforts and then the repair is what's going to be the biggest bear, right? You mentioned the impacts to trucking into rail, not super big. We're going to be seeing more impacts on the dray and the marine side, especially because the channel going through there is really one singular channel, right? There's not necessarily a ton of alternatives for ships going into or out of the port there at Baltimore. We've already seen some freight forwarders and some BCOs start to come forward. Ryan Peterson, CEO of Flexport, tweeting that they had, I think, about 300 containers that were aboard the ship that was impacted. And they also have about 800 total containers that are going to have to be rerouted on their current shipments. Talk a little bit about what this looks like from a cost perspective for us, Thomas. We know, as you mentioned, not necessarily seeing an impact into trucking spot market. What about on the maritime side?
On the maritime side, we're definitely going to be seeing some shifts just because moving into that port, there was around 35 or 40 ships that were waiting offshore at the time of the incident. This is a port that, while is much smaller than some of the southern ports like Savannah, only a fraction of it, it still has a situation where even when you're looking at imports for things like flooring, for instance, I've ran freight out of that market coming in. And so the reroute is going to cause problems because it will incur extra costs. Ship owners, when you're charting the sailing, we saw this with issues with the Panama Canal and even the Suez Canal. If you have to change the route, especially if you're underway and you're a week away, it's going to cost a little bit extra money, crew, fuel, and that's going to get passed down onto customers. So I think the biggest thing we are going to see is disruptions in these maritime spot rates going into the East Coast. And it's not a good situation looking ahead in the next 6 months, because imagine this, the labor unions on the East Coast are coming due for their negotiations. And so imagine a situation where the ILWU, the longshoremen, and all the other unions on Baltimore are having to deal with the fact that they're getting less work while they get this thing sorted out in the short term. And then we're looking at the additional potential cost incurring. So who stands to benefit? Well, probably ports like Savannah that can cover extra capacity, or even ports on the West Coast if it gets that bad. I mean, the East Coast does have quite a few options. So having a situation like Baltimore, while it is not good and we will see disruptions, I'm pretty confident that the overall supply chain, given our other ports, even like, look, New Jersey, New York area, that Newark spot, Norfolk has one of those, which is interesting with Baltimore. They both put a bridge in front of everything that you have to go under. Fun times. So keep an eye on that. But even Jacksonville, Miami, we've got Houston, you know, we've got various smaller ports. So it is an interesting situation. Final thoughts, that was a 5,000 TEU container. So people are asking, why didn't the bridge do a better job? Well, the bridge was made in the 70s, folks. The ships were not as large. You know how much a 5,000 TEU container ship weighs? Isaac Newton does, because it's hundreds of thousands of pounds hitting one of those small pillars. So unfortunately, while our containerization and ships got a lot bigger, our infrastructure was not thinking about it. And they didn't have little things called dolphins, little things you can put in front. But I even think that would have stopped it. Those things are beasts. So a lot of stuff to unpack. We will see disruption. We will see some higher rates in the short term. But I'm pretty confident the supply chain will make adjustments, just because Baltimore, it punches below its weight.
And part of that reason, of course, being the Howard Tunnel there, having height restrictions in the intermodal space. They've been fighting to get that Howard Tunnel redone and raised now for almost a decade in the infrastructure space. They're going to have to divert some attention, of course, to rebuilding the bridge as well. Let's move on to our second topic here today, talking about solar panels and trucking companies, two things that you think wouldn't go well together, but do they have a reason to match?
This is a fascinating one. GP Transco, pulling up my notes here, a lot of facts and figures. Let's go. A 600-truck fleet, they tested it on 10 trucks over a six-month period. They're solar panels. These things are really cool. One of the challenges is the batteries on these Class 8 tractors. You got to imagine that not only when you're idling, you're keeping the truck running for things such as basic living amenities like air conditioning. You're also running things like fridges. You may be having like little microwaves, gaming systems, little driver quality of life things. They usually run through a power strip. Use an extra inverter and stuff like that. But putting the solar panels on top of the tractors is going to be a fascinating thing, as well as trailers, because it's going to provide more power. It helps reduce that battery drain. They estimate it's going to save them about $1,700 per tractor per year. And so it's a really fascinating number. I'm pretty excited to see. This is something you don't really see a lot of folks talking about, but especially with dry van and reefer units, getting that extra juice from solar panels really helps out, and it even keeps the batteries alive longer. You'd be shocked to find out how hard it is to jump start dead truck batteries because the drivers left them on or left things running. It happens a lot more common than you would think.
This seems like kind of low-hanging fruit, especially as we know that drivers spend a pretty decent chunk of their time waiting, often in times in yards where there's not a whole lot overhead to obstruct those solar panels from getting that solar energy. Begs the question, why haven't we done this sooner? Are we looking at an additional weight restriction because you're adding the solar panels on top of the trucks, which will then reduce the amount of cargo? Or what's kind of the main reason why this hasn't been done yet?
Really, three things: cost, complexity, and the utilization, how efficient these panels are. You know, every year these panels are getting more efficient. The wafers, the silicon wafers and stuff are getting a lot better. It's just in the past, they didn't really make financial sense because you could absorb stuff from the sun, but you know, you're only as good as your panel in terms of absorbing solar energy. So it's kind of this thing where this technology is starting to mature. They were originally developed by the U.S. for the U.S. Army, Merlin Solar said, and it was used for military vehicles. And so what was fascinating was that in spite of it being developed for a war zone, the challenges in the environment of OTR trucking is so very different, especially given the long hours on the road and going across the coast-to-coast of the United States. It presented a unique set of challenges that they also had to work around, because you can imagine all it takes is a few hailstorms. We saw that in Texas, knocking out about thousands of acres of solar farms. So, you know, there were a few little things to work out, but it's good to see fleets starting to do this, because I think that what we are forgetting is the downstream costs. Super important to think about in terms of battery wear, battery life, and how that impacts utilization by not having to wait 45 minutes to an hour for someone to come jumpstart you.
As anyone in the plains can tell you, hailstones, even like about dime size or bigger, plus solar panels, are not a good combination, and they end up equaling more dollars spent. Thomas, let's go ahead and talk really quickly about your show coming up, and as well as your newsletter.
Coming up, newsletter fun stuff on next week, April the 2nd. We're having Abhishek Gupta, Vice President of Product at Motive, talking about AI vision. We're putting AI in dash cams, folks, and it is very, very clever. Also going to be talking about in the newsletter here a lot of trucking conditions and stuff. You know, we're going to, usually I like to pair in some data, and we'll mention as well probably backlink some of the bridge as we as this situation develops. But there's a lot of stuff going on. TCA conference, and there was a Matt's conference as well. Going to try to see if there's anything useful to throw it in there.
Absolutely. Spring has sprung, but is the freight market responding? Tune in to Thomas Wasson, and he will give you maybe not clarity, but at least some crystal ball answers. Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.